Good evening. You are listening to the Year Now podcast. Today is the 4th of...
No, it's the 3rd.
April. 7th of April. We're coming from the future.
No, I will get it edited before then. So, yes, it's the 3rd of April, 2024. And as you've heard, joining me this evening, I've got Bronwyn.
Hello.
And Mark.
Hey.
And, so how are we all?
Roman's got I'm fantastic, thank you. I'm doing really, really well.
Okay, right. Well, I have had a big change in my life this week. I have just started my new job.
Ooh.
And how is it so far?
Good, yeah. And my second day in today. Yeah, lots of reading to do, reading policies and stuff, and yep, because it's a very secure environment, so lots of security policies to read, and so on, ISO accreditations and so on. But I got to introduce myself to the rest of my team today. We have a daily stand up or daily meeting where we sort of talk about stuff. And it came out that I was previous chair of New Zealand Skeptics because we did the stuff quiz as a team, which apparently is something we're going to do every day, which is very enjoyable. And one of the questions in the stuff quiz today was about Jeremy Corbett and where he was born. And so I said, well, actually, I know Jeremy and still got his birthplace wrong. would either of you hazard a guess as where he was born in New Zealand? It's a place that begins with W.
Who's Jeremy Corbett?
He's the host of 7 Days.
Right. Then yes.
Remember the show that I was on last year?
I would guess Auckland because that's the largest population in New Zealand.
Yeah, Auckland does not start with W.
Auckland. Walkworth sounds like Auckland and starts with a W.
Wanganui would be my guess.
Oh, okay. Well, that's certainly closer than Mark's guess.
Wanaka.
Whangarei.
You're now on the right island.
Hey!
Apparently, he was born in Westport, so over on the west coast.
Okay.
Yes. So anyway, so I got to tell my team about my experience of going on 7 Days last year, which incidentally is actually just coming up to the 1 year anniversary of it because I went and looked up the video on the TV3 website in order to give them the link, and it's only got sort of like a couple of weeks left to watch because you can only watch the shows for a year, apparently.
Do we have a copy of it? Have we managed to legally or otherwise scrape a copy yet?
I don't think so, Mark.
Well, somebody should look into that then.
Yeah.
Would they be able to give you maybe like one of those old-fashioned cassette tapes and you have to go get a VCR to play it?
No. But what I did try and do last year, I think when I was looking at the video online after to try to play it in the web player, was to actually take screenshots of it. And actually it's set up so that you can't take a screenshot, so you try and use the Windows shortcut key to take a screenshot and actually the screen goes blank. So ooh, it's doing something on the site that's detecting when you're trying to take a screenshot and
probably
preventing
just watching key presses and nothing more than that, I imagine.
Except if you lost focus of the application, so you were focused on another application, it was still preventing it.
Okay, maybe not that then. I don't know.
Anyway, so if we were to get it, we would probably have to set up a video camera and or a phone and it just pointed at the screen in order to capture.
No, I have done my fair share of hacking Brightcove and other technologies that are used to try and stop people downloading videos. In fact, I was once the author of a plugin for a popular media project called XBMC, now called Kodi, where I wrote the software that was able to stream the TVNZ and TV3 channels off the internet, despite the fact that the companies didn't want me to do it. The only thing I had a problem streaming that I wasn't able to add to my plugin was streaming the adverts. They made it harder for me to get the advert streams and play those than the actual TV shows they were trying to protect, which to me was very weird. But yeah, so it's hard, but it's not impossible to grab the data from these things.
You can't go stealing the copyright of the advertisers. That's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I figured they'd want them played. I thought I was going to be good with my plugin. I was going to add the adverts and make people watch them so that at least I felt good about myself. But I couldn't do it. It was just impossible to grab those streams. but the content itself wasn't very well protected for a while. And then suddenly they upped their game and my plugin stopped working. And it was a sad day for New Zealand.
Right. So the other thing about my new job is that I got invited out this morning for a coffee with my manager. And so we wandered down the road in Ponsonby to a cafe, and I was kind of put on the spot. And as you know, I'm not a coffee drinker.
Oh,
but today,
did you pretend
today,
to be one?
No, today I ordered a coffee and drank a coffee.
And are you still wired now? Is this like you're going to be up until
perhaps.
2 o'clock in the morning?
It's why you're going to get the podcast done today. You know, you're going to be up all night. So tell us, you know, all Kiwis want to know, what did you order as your coffee that, you know, as a coffee person who doesn't drink coffee? A flat white.
Yeah. Good choice. Good, solid choice. And
how
what did you think of it?
Watered down.
I didn't mind it at all. And my previous objection to drinking coffee is that I actually just don't drink hot drinks because I've always hated the very hot liquid in my mouth and the possibility that it's going to burn my lips and tongue and move my mouth and everything. And it was fine. So attaining the age of 58, I've finally grown up to drink adult beverages.
Who'd have thought that something that billions of people have been doing for many, many years was actually safe, drinking hot water?
Well,
could
you know
not
that
have guessed
I'm skeptical.
That. well done for trying it for yourself.
But here's the thing. Do you eat soup? Do you have the same concerns about soup?
I do have the same. In fact, I have the same concerns about any hot food.
So have you tried gazpacho soup then? Do you stick to like cold soups, Bloody Mary soup?
I will eat hot soup and hot foods in general, but I just prefer them to cool down quite a bit. I hate it when I burn the sort of top of my mouth and you get that blistering effect, and it feels awful for days.
Oh, well, you've just got a precious mouth. I like it.
Maybe I do. I've got young, sensitive skin in my mouth. anyway, so we better get started on some topics. Mark, your assignment is to give us a 600-word dissertation on whether Jesus rose from the dead.
Yeah, that's not what I did. The one thing that I think sparked my interest in doing this is that Bronwyn seems to be writing longer and longer articles. And I haven't checked how long articles are, but I'm presuming she already has the record for the longest article ever written for the New Zealand Skeptics. I went the other way. I thought, what's the shortest article I can write for the skeptics? And my article titled Did Jesus Rise from the Dead is one word, no. I wrote it and then I felt a little bit guilty because I'm a skeptic. I can't just say no, you know, I need to put up or shut up. There needs to be some evidence here. So I put a little asterisk and I added four links to what I found were fairly good quality articles. Maybe not so much the Michael Shermer one at the end. That was so-so, half good, half not so good. But the articles I put in there were just to back up this idea. And I wondered whether maybe we could talk about it quickly. I mean, I'm sure we all deal with Christians. And I thought, Craig, your story about, you know, going to the going out for a coffee with your boss today, maybe it was going to be that he was a committed Christian and you had to explain that you were an atheist, because that can be a fun discussion to have. My last company, my boss was a Christian, and we had some fascinating conversations about creationism and his really, really bad misunderstanding of evolution. but I take it you haven't bumped Christians at work yet?
I don't know. But in the discussion today, in the meeting, like people said, oh, what's the skeptics thing all about? And I said, oh, well, we're just basically, we'd like you to have evidence for your beliefs. And I rattled through a few things like psychics and alternative medicine and so on. And then somebody said, oh, what about religion? I said, okay, I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah, not on day two. I don't want to be sacked within a week of getting the job.
But when you think about it, it's been quite a timely topic in New Zealand, particularly with the attacks, or say, quote unquote, attacks on the Rainbow Crossings, both in Gisborne and in Kay Road in Auckland.
Can you blame that on religion, though, or can you just blame that on that dickhead, Brian Tamaki?
Well, Brian Tamaki has been going on a Reality Check Radio saying that, you know, trying to encourage people to, you know, he's going to be part of the, he's going to get rid of this trans gay scourge of our nation.
Good luck with him doing that, because I don't think he's going to manage it. And thank goodness he's going to fail miserably. But yeah. So, I mean, it's obviously relevant because of that and obviously because of Easter. But it's always interesting talking with religious people as a skeptic, because unless we're one of those very rare skeptics that does somehow manage to hold on to religion as well, I mean, it almost feels like it's the kind of thing we do have to be embarrassed about and do have to kind of tread really carefully, is about people's religious beliefs. But religious beliefs, they're just another belief. They're just another thing that really we should bring evidence to bear on. This is just yet another topic where it's, you know, what do you believe and what are your reasons for believing it? Like, do you have a good basis for believing this thing? And I don't think we should shy away from it. And generally, in my conversations, I try not to. I try to be as honest with people as I am when talking about chiropractic or acupuncture or free energy machines. I mean, it's just like, cool, show me the evidence. And if you can't show me the evidence, A, I'm not going to believe it. And B, I don't think you're justified in believing it either, no matter how much comfort it might bring you, or how much it's a fun pet project to do on a Sunday or watching YouTube videos. You've either got the evidence or you haven't. If you haven't got the evidence, and if the plausibility seems quite low, which I think for Jesus rising from the dead, in a way it is, in a way maybe it isn't, because God can do anything, he's all powerful. But certainly, you know, like, I guess with anything historical, evidence is a hard thing, right? And the further back you go, the more flaky evidence gets for anything. And so Jesus rising from the dead, Jesus turning water into wine, Jesus walking on water, like these things, it might be written in a book that he did it, but I don't think that's a good reason to accept this as true.
So back in the day when I first started out to be a skeptic, I had a colleague at work who was a devout Christian, a young earth creationist, and I had done a bit of reading at the time, and what I understood at the time was that if you studied the four New Testament books, what they call the Synoptic Gospels, are they, that you can't, the Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, that if you look at the accounts of what happens with Jesus rising from the dead, you cannot actually reconcile all those four accounts and come out with a coherent story that actually makes any sense.
Yes, and part of the Gospels is copying, right? So, you know, I think most biblical scholars agree that there is a route you can follow through from one Gospel to another, and this guy copied off of these two guys, but also what they think is a hidden Gospel, which I think is document Q. This extra Gospel that there are remnants of in the copying that's been done from it, but it's not extant. We don't have a copy of it now. It's just something that's inferred. And it's really interesting to be able to infer that kind of thing, that, you know, you can figure out that these things are likely. But yeah, one thing I noticed while looking for evidence, either in favor or not, from a skeptical science-based perspective, is that the articles that I did link to and find that were basically trying to be rational and scientific about this question of did Jesus rise from the dead, they were swamped by the number of articles that were just unquestioningly, well, kind of given that he did rise from the dead, yada, yada, yada. There were so many articles, even from like universities in America, that almost seem to start with the assumption that, well, obviously it's true, and they'd go from there, or they just, the reasoning they had for why it was true was just so facile. You know, why would so many believe it if it wasn't true? Why would people risk their lives if it wasn't true? Why would the apostles have done these things that might have killed themselves afterwards if they hadn't seen him come back from the dead? Surely that was the only thing that would motivate them. Of course, we've seen people in multiple religions die for their religion when it's obviously false. This is the same argument that Mormons use, that why would Joseph Smith risk his life if it wasn't something that actually happened. It's like, well, probably because he had a good gig going. But yeah, so I was really disappointed to see, just at least from a skeptical perspective and a scientific perspective, how much the water is muddied online by very, I guess, biased. I mean, I'd like to think as skeptics, we're not biased. I know people say we are. We're biased towards science and common sense and whatever else. But I think we try to be as free from bias as we can do. But when you look at religious universities in the States, when you look at religious organizations running websites, there is, it seems to be a very strong bias in there for defending their preconceived beliefs. You know, it's not that they're out there honestly and fearlessly searching for what's true. They already know, in inverted commas, what's true, and now they're trying to backfill the evidence for it, which is totally the wrong way around for these things.
Yeah. I think it, in particular, it's been said that historians generally have this bias that Jesus did, in fact, exist as a religious figure and was able to do miracles and rose from the dead. So there is that Christian bias amongst historians that make it be claimed as historical fact, when in fact there really isn't evidence that says that it is.
And just reading things like, you know, that I read something, no figure in history has had more of an effect than Jesus. And I'm like, well, you might think from your Western perspective sitting in America that this is true. But I bet if you're sitting in a Middle Eastern country, that's not how you'd feel at all. I'm pretty sure you'd feel a lot different from any other perspective than a Western Christian perspective. You really wouldn't think that. Jesus is a, you know, he's a bit part in the Quran. He's nothing really as far as Judaism's concerned, pretender to the throne, I guess. And then there's a bunch of other religions that are so far away from that Jesus doesn't even feature.
Anyway, sex life.
Yeah, how's yours, Craig?
I think that's probably getting a little personal for the podcast.
Yeah, that segue was a bit clunky there, Craig.
You forgot the dot. Well, it's sex dot life.
Okay, but yeah, like I thought you were going to just go on for like 2 minutes about Jesus, considering the length of your article.
Yeah, it turns out I did have a lot to say about it, despite only writing the word no. My main article that I wrote for this week was a follow-on to a lot of the work that Bronwyn's done, where she's looked into Haydn Temple just outside Palmerston North and ISTA, the International School of Temple Arts, the sex school, the sex something, Bronwyn? It's not really a school.
Neo-tantric sex international organization party time workshop amalgamation collaboration, I suppose. It's a lot of things.
It is. And especially, you know, given that you tied in as well your channeling series, you know, the idea that Bruce Lyon, who runs Haydn, runs this weird tantric sex school in New Zealand, also thinks that he's channeling a long dead master. I mean, who isn't channeling these days? Having read your articles, I get the feeling that like every other person on the street channeling some long dead guru.
Well, I think while I was writing the article, I went to my local library, the War Memorial Library in Lower Hutt, and even then they were advertising somebody coming from the UK to do a bit of a, who was traveling New Zealand doing a bit of a channeling bit. But the tickets were like $75, and we just couldn't justify that on the skeptics' budget.
Too much, way too much for something that daft, a piece of pantomime. But yeah, so the perspective I took and the thing that really struck me when I listened to this podcast, Sex.Life, which is Morgan Penn, a somatic sexologist who went to a Haydn course, I guess, a couple of years ago now. When I listened to this podcast, the real thing I took away from it, apart from the fact that she was a bit cagey and got more cagey as time went on, as she described her experiences at the 10-day course, you could see her kind of clamming up a bit and realizing some of the problems with it. What I saw was a lot of the problems with her. When I listened to this podcast, something that really, really annoyed me was the amount of nonsense that she spewed on it in 10 episodes. I mean, right out of the gate, as I write in my article, she started strong. She started with that idea that because anal suppositories are a good way to absorb drugs into your body. Therefore, tanning your butthole is a good way of getting vitamin D because it will also absorb sunlight well. And, you know, when you start with a fact that you've made up that's that good, you know it's not going to go well.
And what were your thoughts about her having a menstrual blood facial?
I mean, you know, in one way, if you want to wipe menstrual blood on yourself and that turns you on and that does whatever for you, go for it. That's great. But the idea that it's going to give you some kind of mystical energy or enable something within you, it's just blood. You're putting blood on yourself.
It's the idea that I think that there's stem cells in it and therefore it's supposed to help your face be youthful. But it's like, if menstrual blood was that effective for stem cell harvesting, we would not be going through the, you know, it takes thousands, like it's tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars to collect stem cells. So, you know, we'd be using menstrual blood versus, say, you know, fetuses.
Yeah, presumably the concentration of stem cells in menstrual blood over the duration of a period would be pretty small, pretty low.
I'd have no idea.
True male. Speaking about woman's reproductive health.
There's a whole thing why it doesn't work. You know, basically, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. If it was effective, you know, medical scientists would be all over it. But it just isn't. It's just no good.
Yeah. On the podcast, she talked about things like activating something happening at a cellular level. And this idea that things are going on at a cellular level that we can control, that, you know, we have interaction with as a person. It's just ridiculous. Like, it very much sounds like the Scientology idea of trauma being recorded at a cellular level and you having to get rid of these engrams, these cellular level memories, which is why they have their auditing. And I just couldn't get Scientology out of my head when I heard her talking about this. She talked about orgasmic energy, you know, this special energy that comes from having an orgasm. And then at one point she had an orgasm that apparently lasted pretty much 24 hours. Like, it started in the afternoon, it went through an entire night to the next day, and I'm calling bullshit on that one. I do not think that she had a 24-hour long orgasm, no matter how much she conned herself into thinking she was.
They were calling it the Kundalini energy. That's what they were calling it in the context, of course. I think what happened, I mean, just to speculate, I'm not in her space, headspace, you know, the way that in that particular episode, it seemed to be a very sensory and mentally intense, because this is the one where the guys were like they were staring at each other's genitals. Mm-hmm. That was the activity. Mm-hmm. And this guy who she did not like and did not trust was kind of her partner in this activity, and she just didn't feel safe the entire time. So here's this entire sort of threat response that she has. And it seemed that she had sort of the sensory overwhelm.
Okay, so she was afraid, put on edge. And that lasted for a while, and she went, "Oh, that's an orgasm." I mean, I really hope she's had orgasms. I presume she has. She's a sexologist. She sounds very liberal. I'm assuming she's not one of those unfortunate women that's never experienced an orgasm. I'm assuming she knows what it is. So presumably in some level in her brain, she knows that that was not an orgasm. But yeah, just listening to this and the activities they were doing as well, the energetic heart fucking, which was just a good hug. And a bit of waving your arms around at each other. And, you know, the staring at each other's genitals was an interesting one. One that I had a real problem with, and Bronwyn, I've talked to you about it already, and I think you had similar concerns, was the one they were doing the prostate massage, where they were sticking their fingers up each other's butts. And, you know, again, if that's what you want to do, that's great. Enjoyable thing, I'm sure. But she talked about how she was good to do this because he ended up having trauma. He ended up talking about being sexually abused.
Yeah, so this particular exercise that Mark's talking about, everyone got paired up with different people. And in the storyline of this whole season of the podcast, Morgan has this conference boyfriend or workshop boyfriend, as they kind of call it in the industry. Like, these, you know, you're in these sort of intense situations and you can, and you know, it's not unusual to build a really intense short-term relationship with other attendees. So she has this workshop boyfriend or workshop relationship or workshop situationship, and then she decides, oh, I want to do something else. So she chooses, she's either she's paired or she chooses this guy. I forget what the story was. So it was, you know, it was a random guy, and he was kind of apparently, it sounded like he was giving off indications that, you know, this whole exercise was not for him in the first place.
Mm-hmm. But they did it anyway, and apparently she was gentle and looked after him. And she talked about how, because she was trauma-informed and professionally able to deal with this, he was lucky that he came to her and not to anybody else in the group of, I think it was about 50 attendees at this course that she was on. Mm-hmm. But I looked her up on the Institute of Sexology, whatever the hell it is. We might talk about that in a minute. And it has a list of specializations. It has a list of things that apparently each sexologist is trained on. And one of the things that she's not trained on, that she does not have a tick in her box for, is trauma. So apparently she's not that the certification, as far as I can tell, is worth anything, but even if it was, she's not supposed to be doing any kind of trauma work. So the idea that it was good that he came to her and that, you know, she was professionally able to deal with this, total nonsense from beginning to end. And just hearing that whole episode, like, I can't help but think that with these kinds of courses, with these kinds of things, because it's amateurs doing it. I mean, there are people who are trained in sex therapy. There are people who are professionals who have a code of conduct and who have spent years learning how to do this thing safely. That's not what these people are. And I can't help but think that these people are likely doing more damage than they are good, that in the long term, it's going to be horrible for people.
And this is not the criticism. Like, that particular criticism does not come out in any of the 10 episodes.
No.
She talks about, you know, she would not recommend people going to the place in the state that it is in now, in the sense that there isn't, you know, people aren't getting fully informed consent about what's happening, because the whole thing is the whole hide-in, whether it's a hide, I think it was more of an ISTA. It was more of an ISTA activity than a hide-in activity, but not quite sure, because I can't find any ads for it or any promotional, like archive promotional material for it. But, you know, to go in there, a lot of things are kept from you. Particularly, I think, yes, from the New Zealand and American stuff. Whereas I know in the UK, having seen ads for more of the European ISTA offerings, they are a bit more upfront with telling you about how they're going to do that, what they call the sacred spot massage, which is that G-spot massage, either, you know, massaging the prostate or elsewhere for a woman. So.
But yeah, so as she did point out a couple of red flags, and one of them was that you don't see the curriculum in advance. You sign up for a 10-day course. You have no idea of what you're going to be asked to do. And I think for the people that run it, I don't know whether it's naivety or whether it's deliberate ignorance, but they seem to act as if, oh, no, it's fine because we let people know that they don't have to take part in anything, which is totally not understanding how humans work and how peer pressure works and how the feeling of needing to conform works. Because often when you're in a group like that and somebody suggests something that you're not willing to do, but the 49 people around you appear to be willing to do, you will go along with it because it's too embarrassing to not go along with it. What you probably don't realize is that half the people in the room also feel the same as you, but everybody's doing it because they think everybody else is totally fine with it.
But they also, okay, Craig, you go first before I have my point.
I have the same fear about my teammates at my new workspace.
You have what fear?
That they're gonna suggest that we do something, and I'm just gonna go along with it.
This is the first time you've worked with a team for a long time, isn't it?
Well, true, true.
they'll be nice to you, I'm sure.
Yes, we're all going to go and have a team acupuncture session or something.
Do it. It would be fun.
Yeah, we still gotta get Mark's colonic on the go.
Yeah, I think I might have to just lose my colonic voucher because it's only the days that I'm working and not available. So I'm gonna have to book something in town on a weekend, sadly. So it's gonna cost me some extra money, but the voucher was a very kind present. Mm. Anyway, Roman, you were gonna say.
Yeah, I want to go back to this point because I mean you have to, like, they call these sort of spaces that they create within these workshops containers. And it's kind of this other world where, you know, the boundaries of the outside world don't come in, but there are different sorts of rules. And within the container, and from Morgan's narrative that she shared, you know, there's quite a lot of setup in terms of everything is fated, you know, so they would have these activities when they had to choose different partners, and everyone had to pick like different objects, and you would go and you'd find your partner as the person who had the other, maybe say you picked up a pine cone, then your partner would be the other person who had a pine cone, and that would be your partner for the activity. So there's a lot of that messaging that was sort of embedded and reinforced throughout this whole, that everything that happens to you is fated. And that does sort of extend to their more questionable, how you say, facilitators, people who sort of built a reputation from that, from the ISTA model, who a negative reputation, that they'll have these opinions that, you know, there are no victims.
Yeah.
And
And
that's what's
this.
tied into this point as well. Like, you know, everything kind of supposed to happen to you. You
Yeah.
chose this, as you said, as
Yeah.
you show that picture, Mark.
Yeah. So, as you say, Bronwyn, after we went to Hamilton and spent the weekend with Craig in Auckland, we stopped at the outside of Hyden Manor on the way down. And one thing I noticed looking through the massive metal gates was on the other side in the distance, on the side of the path up the driveway, is a sign that says you chose this, which at first I was scratching my head, like, why would they say that? But the more I've learned about about ISTA and about Haydn, the more it becomes obvious that this is one of those things where this is your choice. We're not to blame. Whatever happens to you, you've got to remember that you chose this, and there's no repercussions for us because this is your journey. This is your responsibility. There's no such thing as a victim. This is all you. And like, again, this is not the kind of thing you get in real therapy. If a real therapist screws you over, there will be repercussions for that therapist. But these people are trying to have all the benefits of making good money out of offering therapy without all of the bummer downside of being responsible for the things that you do, which is not how you're supposed to do things. This really should be regulated like every other kind of therapy in the country.
And this is actually, I think this might be Morgan's second or third podcast, because while she was training to be a sexologist, she did have a podcast about that process
Yes.
and
Yeah.
training to
So
be.
I haven't listened to that one yet, but it did come up while I was doing Google searches. So I might listen to it at some point. But yeah, so her certification is from the Somatic Sex Educators Association of Australasia, the SSEAA. And as from what I can tell, it's just a few people that decided that they were somatic sexologists and they started an organization to legitimize it. And they're like, we are the worldwide body. You have to come to us to be certified as a somatic sexologist. And it's a bunch of online stuff, and you've got to go in person for part of the course. It's not cheap. She will have forked out $10,000 plus for this, plus on top of that, her flights over to Australia. And she learned a bunch of stuff that, as far as I can tell, none of it is really evidence-based. Sexological body work is the umbrella that all of this comes under. Now, the normal body work, which seems to be like a generic, non-trademarked version of Rolfing, is an alternative medicine that is just totally off the wall nonsense. But this sexological body work includes, they've got a list on their website of active receiving. I don't know what that is. Anal touch. I've got a fair idea what that is. Internal and external genital mapping, breath work, scar tissue remediation, and orgasmic yoga coaching. Now, the genital mapping seems to be the thing that Morgan focuses on. She's renamed it to a yoni map using a Sanskrit word, yay for cultural appropriation. And she's basically, she will get you in touch with your genitalia. She will help you to explore your genitals and feel comfortable with them. Again, practically, it sounds like it's probably a positive thing for people that haven't done this, who don't feel comfortable, who have nervousness and other things. But it's just wrapped up in all this spiritual mumbo jumbo that, like, makes no sense. Yes,
Do you
Craig.
think that somebody who's nervous about their genitals is actually going to show up at one of these courses to explore?
No, so this is not so much the ISTA course. This is her private practice where it's a one-on-one.
Oh,
So for
but
this, even so,
the
even
guy that she
so.
worked with, you know, did have these anxieties, and I think that's the problem. That's kind of the other half of the issues that we've talked about before with ISTA and Haydn, is that there isn't a screening process. It's very much a business, you know. You pay thousands of dollars, you can come. And that's the problem when you have all these facilitators who've maybe done this course before, but none of them are actually educated in trauma. No one's really, like, I mean, there may be one or two now. They may have a couple of psychologists on staff, but that's actually, there's no consistent education to make sure people are safe. And also, again, it goes back to this, you choose this, you as a participant. So if participants who have a history of trauma and they haven't worked through it, or, you know, they haven't received any counseling or therapy, you know, they chose. So no one's really going to get into their space or say, you can't be here. You aren't healed. No one.
And when you say no screening for the course, Bronwyn, what you're talking about, of course, is not only no screening of weirdos that are going to be like creeping everybody out for the week, but there's no screening of sexual diseases either. You know, they ask you to do it. They say, we'd love it if you could go and get yourself checked before you turn up so you don't spread gonorrhea to everybody, but they don't enforce it. They don't ask to see the results. They just trust that you would go and do this by yourself and you're not going to turn up without having bothered, which again, nobody should be running something like this where you're not making sure that everybody is healthy before they turn up.
You just pray the disease or infection away.
But yeah, so like, what I think one of the things I got to in my head, having listened to this and having listened to her talk, and she's very honest, which was really good because it gives a good insight into what's going on. But what you can see is she is weirded out at times, like the smell of a dead raccoon and things like this when she's trying to get sexy. But a lot of the time she is turned on and she is doing it for sexual gratification. And as far as I'm concerned, Ken, it's fine. If you want to be in a room of 50 people all having sex together, this is something that turns you on. You should be free to do this. Nobody should be shaming you. But wrapping this up in this spiritual idea that you are better than everybody else and you're doing this amazing thing, like, this is a sex kink. This is a way that you get off. Enjoy it, but stop pretending it's something highly spiritual and evolved, because it's not. This is just the way you enjoy sex. And it's fine as far as it goes, but no. Stop pretending that, you know, it's worth thousands of dollars to turn up, or that it's something that's making you better than other people. It's not.
Do we have a rating on this podcast?
Not anymore. I think X is the new rating. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah,
I
mean, this is not a podcast you're going to be listening with to your daughters as you drive them to school, will you there, Mark?
Well, my 16-year-old daughter's in the next room to me, and she tells me that she can hear everything when I'm recording a podcast. So she's getting a sex education by proxy at the moment.
I'm sure she's blocking your ears.
Probably. I did buy her noise-canceling earphones for Christmas, so hopefully she's using them.
But, you know, I think one thing we need to probably acknowledge about the Sex.Life podcast, and maybe this may come off as sour grapes to some people, but that podcast got one gold as the best sex and relationship podcast in the 2023 New Zealand Podcast Awards.
Can we go in that category now?
Probably.
I can't help but think that we probably did a better job of talking about sex and relationships. I mean, that podcast had some exercises at home that were mildly interesting, but the amount of disinformation on that podcast, I think probably should have disqualified it straight away.
Well, it didn't say best health podcast. It was best sex and relationship. So, you know, sex and relationship doesn't necessarily need to include accurate information.
No, it doesn't have to be reality based. It could be complete fantasy.
Yeah.
Okay, we're done with that.
I think I've had my rant. Thank you for hearing me out, guys.
However, you may, you know, watch this space, because they do have a second season out of Sex.Life, so I will be probably writing about that.
You preempted me by using that phrase.
Yeah, that was Craig's next segue.
I was specifically not going to use that phrase in this podcast. Because I thought you'd become sensitive about me using it.
I am sensitive about you using it because it's my phrase.
Indeed. All right. So I did a bit of writing about Donald Trump, who's one of my favorite characters, anti-characters, I guess. And so over the past week, he has launched a Bible sale. And so I always learn some interesting facts whenever I'm writing these articles. And so a few of the facts that I learned about this anyway, so we'll get to that. Trump came out last week on his social media platform saying Happy Holy Week. And so I had never heard the week before Easter referred to as Holy Week before, but apparently it's considered Holy Week. And of course, Good Friday is the beginning of the Easter weekend. And so on. But yeah, so Trump has launched this website called God Bless the USA Bible. And this is apparently a collaboration with a guy who wrote a song called God Bless the USA. And his name is Lee Greenwood. He's actually been around for quite a few decades. The song actually goes back to the 80s. He wrote it in the 80s. It's a very patriotic song. It talks about whatever happens in his life, even if he lost everything, he would still love to be an American because at least he knows he's free. And the song is incredibly patriotic. It even has a verse at the end where it jumps into military snare drum rhythm and basically talking about the military at that point and how wonderful it is that they're going away to protect American citizens against all the enemies of the US.
Wow, so do you think maybe the Marines sponsored this music then?
No, I don't know. Anyway, but this particular song keeps being played at supposedly patriotic events in the US. So it became very popular again when the US went into the Desert Storm War in 1991. And then also at the 9/11 attacks in 2001. And so back in 2021, this guy, Lee Greenwood, he actually launched this God Bless the USA Bible, trying to cash in on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And so this Bible is actually, it's a sort of a tan colored Bible with an embossed American flag on the front. And I reflected in the article that the tan color of the Bible matches quite nicely with Donald Trump's face. It's remarkable how closely the colors actually match. And so this Bible has got all sorts of patriotic things in it. From a USA perspective, it's got the Pledge of Allegiance. It's got a copy of the Constitution. It's got a copy of the lyrics of the song. And so back in 2021, so Lee Greenwood was trying to sell the Bibles for $49.99. So Donald Trump has marked that up to $59.99. Though I guess in this age of hyperinflation, that's reasonable. You can go to this website and order this Bible. I don't believe anybody of right mind would go and do this.
I would like to disagree with you. I really want a copy of this Bible. I am
Okay.
a collector of
You are the
nonsense.
one. You are the one who I thought would be the. Speaking of collector of nonsense, Mark is now wearing a MAGA hat. Dear.
I mean, I paid like $3 off of AliExpress for this MAGA hat, but it's a collectible, and I wouldn't ever be showing it publicly because there would be a worry that somebody might think that I'm being serious
I'm
with
going
it.
to
But
screenshot
nope, hats off. But I would really like a copy of this. I just could not stomach paying $60, knowing where that $60 is going. So in 10
Well,
years' time,
and
when it
$60
starts,
US.
when it starts showing up in New Zealand charity shops, I will pick myself up a copy for $2.
So the things that I learned while writing this article. So firstly, I pointed out that Trump has always put his name to a whole bunch of things, and usually they've gone down in flames. So in the past, he's sold steaks, he's sold ties, he's sold menswear, he's sold vodka. All of these things are now defunct. They've all been failed adventures. His latest
Real
thing
estate,
was,
university.
well, yes, yeah. I mean, the university thing was a complete scam, complete fraud, and he had to pay out $25 million to the students or something. And most recently, he's come out with these $400 gold upper sneakers that look completely ridiculous. But so back in the early noughts, there was this video that surfaced online of Donald Trump promoting Trump's House of Wings. And so I had seen this video before, and it's Donald Trump dressed up in a yellow suit, surrounded by people dressed up as chickens, with a broken shell on their head, and dancing to the song in the tune of the Pointer Sisters' Jump. And I thought it was actually some real promotion that Donald Trump was doing, and he actually was selling wings and doing this completely ridiculous promotion of them. But it turns out that this was actually a parody sketch on Saturday Night Live. And he participated in it, parodying himself as being essentially willing to sort of step up and attach his name to anything to promote him, to promote himself or to try and make sales out of this. So, yeah, I kind of learned, okay, all right, that thing wasn't real. It was just a parody.
But still quite telling, even being a parody.
Well, indeed, yes. Yeah. And so the other thing I learned about this is that there are many, many, many versions of the Bible in English.
And all of them are the perfect translation and the right version according to whichever religion has adopted it, right?
Well, yes. But the Bible that Lee Greenwood tried to sell back in 2021 was actually the New International Version of the Bible, the NIV. And that is a translation that was done back in the 80s, and it was recently updated in 2011. And so that has copyright attached to it. But this latest version that Donald Trump is selling is the KJV Bible, so the King James version of the Bible, which was translated back in the 17th century. So back in the 1600s, early 1600s, King James the First of England commissioned this translation of the Bible. And this is the Bible. This is the Bible version that has all the antiquated language in it, like thine and thy and all the stuff that
these and thous.
Yep. Yep. That is very difficult to understand these days. So what they call it is a formal translation where they actually took the original Hebrew and
Aramaic,
yes. Was that right? No, wasn't it Greek?
I don't know.
Greek and Hebrew or something.
Yeah. Greek and Hebrew, anyway. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So that's a formal translation where they're taking essentially word for word and translating it into English, and obviously the English of the time, of the 17th century. But the NIV version, the modern version, is actually it has dynamic equivalents, where essentially they analyzed what they think the original translation was trying to say, and they have put it into modern English words. So it's kind of like taking, okay, this is the intention of this text, this is what is trying to be conveyed, and writing that out in English language as people would understand it today. And I guess that's a much easier Bible to take your meaning from if you're trying to figure out what God and his words in the Bible are trying to say, if you can even believe that it is God's word, which many people do, of course. But yeah, so there's those two different versions. And so I would have thought that if people are trying to promote Christianity and actually getting the true word of God out there and having people understand it, they would be better to use a version that actually is in plain English versus the one that's in 17th century English.
But as you point out, there are licensing costs involved with that, right? So going for one that's way out of copyright, as well as charging $10 more. So he's charging more and he's cutting costs.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. So I also found out from Wikipedia that there are well over 100 English language translations of the Bible, which is an amazing number. Yeah. There are over 3,000 in 2,100 languages in the world. So yeah,
and some of them go like right to the opposite extreme of King James, as becoming basically like a novel. People have written versions of the Bible that are just like reading a fictional book, which we could argue maybe it is.
And so the other point that was made in reading about this was that there's a guy who posts quite regularly on Twitter, or X as it's now called, Seth Abrahamson, and he's actually written a biography of Trump, and he claims that Trump is actually an atheist. He doesn't actually believe any of this stuff, which is quite believable, I guess. Although I mean, from what we've heard of Trump, he doesn't have deep thoughts about anything. Yeah, he could well be the first actual atheist US president. And it's a shame that the first US atheist president turned out to be such a dick and couldn't actually use his atheism for good.
And one of the ones that acts the most Christian in some ways as well, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the telling things has been when And it hasn't happened very often, but those few times when journalists have tried to ask him questions about his faith and yes. like his total lackluster answers to them, I think are quite telling, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. So there was that famous interview where some Christian leader sat down with him and interviewed him about the Bible and said, "Oh, can you tell us what your favorite verse of the Bible is?" And he said, "Oh, no, I wouldn't want to get into that. It's very personal." And then they even asked him whether he actually liked the Old Testament or the New Testament more. And he basically hummed and hawed about that and said, "Oh, he liked them both as much as the other." And then there was the other time where he gave a speech to a Liberty University audience where he referred to 2 Corinthians as the book of the Bible as 2 Corinthians, which apparently caused some laughter amongst the crowd. So, yeah, he's not a Bible reading Christian, no. But he certainly got a lot of them convinced that he is the second coming.
Yeah, for some people it has gone that far, hasn't it, where they really pretty much deify him.
Anyway, that's my sales pitch for Bibles from Donald Trump.
Well, you have me sold. I want one. Please, none of our listeners, do not buy me a copy. I need to be spending no more than $2 for a copy. Otherwise, the guilt will set in.
Yeah. Certainly, there are secondhand religious materials that come up for sale quite often. And in fact, several years ago, I was going for a walk around my neighborhood and some kind people had put some old DVDs out for sale beside in front of their house, or well, not for sale, just for anybody can take these, we're giving them away. And in amongst that lot was some DVDs from Answers in Genesis.
Oh, so did you take them and deposit them in the round filing cabinet at home?
Yes, I did. I did.
Nice. Well, I managed to pick up my first ever copy of the Bhagavad Gita the other day in a charity shop. I've been after one of those for years, but every time I get offered one on the street, they want money for it. And it's like, I'm not paying money for this. I did pay a little bit, but I paid a little bit to charity, and that makes me much happier.
Right.
As well as actually a book from Benjamin Krem, which I'm looking forward to reading. So that's Share International. The people who think UFOs are parked around Earth waiting for us to learn to share before they come down and give us new technologies and allow us to evolve.
Okay. Bronwyn, I have been watching this space forever, and apparently there's now an update on Pasha.
Yeah. So finally, after a couple of weeks, I've gotten my rear into gear and wrote part two. Quite a lot of what I wrote about in the part two of the segment on Pasha we already discussed on a podcast episode a few weeks ago, so nothing really new to our keen listeners, just maybe stuff that was new for our keen readers. But I did want to just give people a really quick update regarding what's happening to Yasmin Clark and John O'Spark as they try to build a new life in India. I was really kind of curious as to what brought it on, because as I was looking through their website, like through their Facebook page and through what the archive version of their main Pasha website, or at least what people have chosen to archive through the Internet Archive, no real explanations. It seems that from an outsider perspective, this move came out from nowhere. But I'm sure people who are in the inner circle were probably more aware of this happening. I guess you kind of got to go back to 2019, because initially back then, that's when Jono and Yasmin sort of started hinting at, hey, we're putting all the cards out on the table. We need to change our pace of life. You know, we're thinking about selling their farm, and they had an eco resort, and they're going to sell the restaurant. And by about 2019, 2020, as far as they got was selling the restaurant, which was selling their stake in Hello Sunday, which is a very popular brunch spot in South City Christchurch. And then after that, they sort of, you know, they kept on with the eco retreat, the Sundari eco retreat for a while. They did sell their farm and they moved to Governor's Bay, and they have a house, and they had a house up there. And then in about 2021, they sold the Sundari, they sold their eco retreat, and they were building a little sort of looks like a little granny apartment at the bottom of their Governor's Bay property, but it was more of a studio for people to go in for them to do their have their business there. And then, yeah, sort of while they were overseas in India, they have this business where they do lots of personal tours, both like motorcycle tours, as well as more Raman Pasha based tours. So a bit more spiritual. They kind of announced to everyone I guess the official announcement went out in January that they were going to move to India. Over the next couple of months, their Facebook page was all the stuff about, you know, once the South Island NZ Spirit Fest was finished, which they have a co-ownership with Franco Hecky. A lot of their Facebook page was basically about how they were saying goodbye to people and they're selling off their stuff. And there's a really great picture of all the stuff that they're selling, like, you know, all their tools. But then you can see like the Himalayan salt lamp that they're selling and all the sort of religious iconography. Some of the books is just like, oh yeah, this probably, you know, could have set Mark here.
Yeah. Yeah. I already have a Himalayan salt lamp, but I bet there's a lot of other things I don't have that I could have picked up cheap.
Yeah. There's a lot of lamps you haven't licked yet, is there?
Yeah. I've only licked one salt lamp. And honestly, I was surprised at how salty it was. I just thought it would taste like a rock, not like salt for some reason.
Yeah. You didn't think it was real. Or maybe it's just a bit of salt paint. Who knows? Yeah. So it's interesting. And then eventually, I think once they got to India, they kind of said, hey, look, you know, we just need a different pace of life, you know, slow things down a little bit. But they're not really slowing things down a lot at all. Yasmin's going to start taking on her private clients again sometime soon. Jono's been zipping around India looking at motorcycles for the motorcycle touring business. And one of their more recent blogs, they're sitting at this little little food stall, and Yasmin's giving the massive stink eye. I mean, she's eating corn, but this isn't like, you know, trying to smile when your mouth is full of corn. She was looking pretty. She was giving him like a death stare. And Jono's saying, yeah, and, you know, eventually we hope to have it, you know, hope to open a retreat or a ashram in honor of my darling. Just the greatest, you know. I had the pause. I was going frame by frame trying to pause just to see if she even smiled. But yeah, no, there was nothing in those eyes. Even though she was wearing sunglasses, you did not see, like, she wasn't smizing, as they say.
So, okay. So, like, we've already got people to apologize to the world for exporting, like Ray Comfort. But now we're having to apologize to India for exporting to them some daft woman who's going to open an ashram and sell people the idea that she's channeling an ancient master and is able to spread the wisdom from thousands of years ago for a price. Yet another scammer that's left our shores and is off, presumably not scamming Indian people. I'm assuming this is for like the white audience, the white travelers.
Certain, like Jono's business, he's having to do a lot of local business. You know, he has driver. They have one tour company that they are partners with, which is India Personal Tours. And then there's going to be this new motorcycle separate business, which is connected to the India Personal Tours. So in that touring business, lots of connection and lots of business relationships with the locals. But yeah, it does seem that potentially the ashram or retreat, if it ever gets off the ground, would be, again, I mean, too, that's New Zealand, potentially international clientele. Though who would staff it? You know, when we think about something like Osho, I mean, you do get, you know, you may have some locals there who will come and staff, but if you can pitch it right. Osho even says, hey, look, you know, it's great if you can pay, but if you volunteer like 6 or so hours a day, then you can stay for free.
Yeah. And there are a lot of young white travelers who are looking to find themselves in India, who I'm sure would be happy to work themselves ragged in order to be able to stay in an ashram for free.
Again, this is literally a watch the space, how quickly they will bring up the ashram, or as maybe some people would call, say, the Osho as a cash ram, how quickly that will come to fruition remains to be seen.
But and presumably, from their New Zealand operation, they will have already made a fair bit of money. Presumably that, you know, they're not going out there with nothing, right?
Well, it's interesting. When I was doing this research about Jono and sort of the Jono side of business, kind of seeing all the different locations Pasha has been, not really sure exactly how much things have cost them, but they had some pretty, you know, I guess modern facilities in Sydenham. Like, you know, they had a really big branded building to themselves. Now, how nice it was inside or how much it actually cost in terms of rental, you don't know. And it looked like they put in a lot of money into the Hello Sunday space because they owned the building. They owned both buildings. So they had the restaurant cafe in one side and then they had the Pasha therapy stuff in the other side, even though the Hello Sunday space sometimes bled into the Pasha building. So you go through to the restaurant and, you know, or go to the bathroom and you see all the passion stuff. So there's lots of, you know, subliminal or overt advertising in a sense for the passion stuff. But again, that seems to be a much, maybe a more boutique and bespoke space, but certainly a bit of a smaller space than what they had out in Sydenham. Then they also had the Sundari retreat, which they also used for their business. And that looked a little bit more run down. It was sort of a semi renovated farm. You know, there's always pictures of them doing lots of their own renovations. And I mean, there's pictures of them doing that, but you never really know exactly how much of their own work that they put into these spots. And then when they moved to Governor's Bay, you know, the house looks like a, you know, a decent, you know, a nice size house, nothing special, because you can still access the old real estate listing. So you can actually see what these properties look like.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it's not high tech. It's just a house. It's a modern house. And then they have the studio property down at the bottom of the lawn, which is, again, is smaller still than the Sundari retreat. So it looks like, you know, there's a constant... It feels like there's a constant downgrade in terms of the properties that they're at. I don't know if that's a reflection of their actual financial state or if maybe the money, that it's just something that allows them to, this is what they can buy and own outright, and then the money can actually be farmed or invested elsewhere, like such as the potentially the immigration grab that is.
Yeah, because I've assumed she's bringing in good money. I mean, the private sessions aren't going to be cheap, and the fact that they have their students as well, presumably, you know, there's fairly good money in that, because there's probably going to be very little in the way of overheads. But it sounds like maybe they've just piled a lot of this into having these buildings, and they might not actually be making good money.
Well, it's going to be interesting, because I believe their house in Governor's Bay, looking at one roof, that sold for under $1 million. So when you think about going from, say, New Zealand to India, you know, you can make your, you know, if they have any profits and haven't put it or haven't kept it, you know, sort of saved, they didn't have any debts before they left in New Zealand, if they still have like a bulk of that cash, they can go for quite a while in India.
Oh, yeah.
Unless there's stuff that they also then need to pay in terms of like bribes or permits or any other obstacles that may come about at, you know, being white foreigners.
Yeah, they're going to have some obstacles with that. But I think India is one of those countries where money can definitely help smooth the way. What would be interesting is to see, and we probably never would see this, but whether they end up basically getting ripped off, because Indians are very good at setting up elaborate schemes to take money from Westerners. I was always very impressed when I was in India to see just how clever they can be at extracting money from people that visit the country. So let's hope that some smart Indian people manage to take all their money and they don't open an ashram, and that they don't end up scamming a bunch of more white people.
It'll be interesting, because they have partnered since 2019 with this India Personal Tours. That seems to be a very legit company, and they have very legitimate positive reviews.
Yeah.
So that seems to be that company that seems to be legit. They seem to have a connection in Germany and in Australia. So they have partners elsewhere. So that's a legitimate business. What happens in terms of the other motorcycle tour remains to be seen. And as you say, it remains to be seen as to what will happen with this retreat. Again, if they ever get off the ground, it may just be that they'll have lower overheads if she just moves completely to a Zoom model.
Yeah, that could work. If they're planning to build an ashram, and like building permits, I can't imagine are going to be an easy thing to get in India, and they'll probably have to partner with somebody local to navigate that. And certainly that's where risk can come when it comes to being scammed by someone. So,
but maybe there's a whole market that we don't know of failed ashrams and retreats, you know?
Oh, you could buy an off the shelf ashram.
One. Yeah.
some American also thought they were going to build a 5-star luxury retreat, and it never, you know, got off the ground. So
yeah,
buy it
could
at
be
a discount.
Do you know whereabouts in India they are?
Udaipur.
Where? Okay. Somewhere in the south, presumably. That's where these places tend to be.
How many states are there in India?
Do you know this, and that's why you're asking us?
Yep. It was a pub quiz question once, and I had no idea, but I remember now the answer.
45 is my guess, and it is a guess.
Okay.
Roman?
No, I couldn't even guess.
Okay. 28.
28.
Yeah. Ah. Yes.
They're actually going to be in the western. It's Udaipur. UDAIPUR.
Udaipur, I think, but I'm probably butchering that as well.
Western, northwestern Indian state
Oh, okay.
of Rajasthan.
Oh, okay.
That's where they are.
I'm just looking at the time. Do we have time to talk about Glory of Ale?
Or would it be better that we talk about it when you guys have both watched a.
Yeah, that might be better, actually.
Yeah, let's. Craig and I will commit to watching the new series on TV, which Bronwyn is called.
Escaping Utopia.
So all our
And where
listeners should
can.
listen to it as well.
Right. And where can we find this?
It'll be on TV on demand, TVNZ on demand.
I said it's on
So,
TV and dead on demand. So it's free to air.
yeah, three
Right.
episodes.
Well, free to stream.
Yeah, free to
Yes.
stream, three episodes. Very, very interesting. You know, I learned some stuff, or I should say a lot of people have been relearning some things that have actually been quite public since about maybe 2015, 2018, like the existence of this Indian community or Indian offshoot
Right, but we're
community of
not
Lorgar.
getting into this now.
It's been in the news. It's been in the news. So,
No spoilers.
no
Look at that.
spoilers.
You're being told off.
Ooh. It's not a spoiler when I said it's been in the news.
It is for me because I haven't watched
You're only spoil
the
your the only thing you're spoiling anyway is your ignorance.
news. Well,
Oh.
true. True. Hey, I know how many states there are in India. I'm not ignorant. I have a mind full of useless facts. So, what's coming up on the calendar?
Couple of things. First, in Wellington, we will have our bi-weekly Skeptics in the Pub in the Intercontinental Hotel in the Hotel Lobby Lounge. The hotel itself is on 2 Grey Street, but don't mix that up with the 2 Grey Street restaurant next door. Festivities start at 6 p.m. on the 5th of April. And then, Mark, what do we have the following week?
So next Thursday, which will be 5 plus 7 minus 1, which is the 11th of April, there will be science-based healthcare activism in the pub. So if you go to the Fork and Brewer in Wellington from about 6:30, we're going to be there doing some activism. And we might still be working on the plagiarism project. We might have moved on to the hair analysis project by this point. But either way, come and join us, get involved in some activism, actually doing some good skeptical work, trying to make a small difference in New Zealand and maybe save a few people from the nonsense that we find out there every day.
And then, if you're in the South Island on Thursday, April 11th at 6 p.m. at Umbrella's Kitchen and Bar, will be the April meeting of the Dunedin Skeptics in the Pub. So go out and meet that crew. It's already got an RSVP of 4 attendees. Let's double that number
Very good.
or more. Triple it, quadruple it.
And should we be marking our calendars for a time in November?
Saving a
Yes, we.
date.
Save the date. Yes, we have finally secured a venue in Auckland, what's called the Fickling Convention Center in Three Kings in Auckland. And that will be the space of the joint NZ Skeptics and the New Zealand Association of Rationalists and Humanists.
Well done, you
Yeah,
got
the
that
NZ.
right.
Yeah,
I
so
am
I'm like,
impressed.
I had to think for a second. But yeah, the NZARH, that we're going to be co-hosting a conference this year. So that'll be the main conference will be on the 16th and 17th. But we also will be doing a
Of
bit of a
November.
of November 2024. But we usually have a traditional little get-together social night on Friday. Now, the details of those events will be gradually revealed, as well as the update of the conference website. So follow us on Facebook as well as on skeptics.nz, and hopefully we'll be starting to sell tickets around May, June-ish.
Did you just do a like and subscribe?
I did just do a like and
Follow us
subscribe.
on
Ring the bell.
Facebook.
Ring the bell.
I'm just quite impressed that the venue has a FCKING in the name.
Yeah, one of our committee members did point out that the sign at the front from a distance does read like something that isn't quite Fickling.
Yeah, but it does have parking, so that's going to be really good for our locals who are going to be coming in. And it looks like a pretty nice venue.
Yeah, no, it looks good. So it's in for those who know Auckland, it's in Mount Roskill / Three Kings, which is probably about half an hour on a bus out of the city, into the suburbs a bit, but certainly a a nice venue surrounded by a bit of bush and sort of green park land and a library, so and close to shops and things, so it'll be easy to go out and grab a coffee for those of us who drink coffee.
Do you count yourself in that number now? Do you think you're ever going to do it again?
I think I will, actually. The challenge for me now is to figure out, surreptitiously probably, how to operate the Nespresso machine at work without destroying it.
Like the coffee pod thing it's fairly easy, but yeah, there'll be YouTube videos you can watch that'll help you.
Yeah, I'll be standing there in the office kitchen with my phone with a YouTube video showing how to run a Nespresso machine. Anyway, we had our Skeptics in the Pub in Auckland last night. We had a reasonable turnout, I think about 8 or 9 of us, including a couple of new people, which is nice to see. We tried a new venue last night. It was the Brew on Quay. Doubtful we'll be going back there again. We thought we were going to have a kind of room to ourselves, and we did, but the room did not have good soundproofing. It was basically an open walls up to a particular point, and then it was clear above that, up to the ceiling, and so all the noise from the main area came into our little area, which is really quite tiny. In fact, there was really only space for about 9 of us in the room. So I think we'll be going back to the Dice and Fork. And also really wasn't convenient. And you had to, if you were driving in, you had to go and pay for parking. That was annoying. I had to park in a car parking building, which cost me $24.
Oh, okay. Now that's a lot of money. That's painful.
Yeah. God, I think I'd probably pay 6 when I park in under the hotel in Wellington.
Yeah, well, that would be a lot more palatable, but yeah. And additionally, it was straight after Easter, and the food was nothing to write home about. The fish and chips were literally fish and some chips.
What are you expecting with fish and chips? Isn't that what fish and chips is?
Well, normally you would have a bit of coleslaw or some sort of salad with it.
Is this how Aucklanders do it? Okay.
Well, particularly for the price, and I had a burger and chips, and the burger bun was quite stale. So I have a feeling they had leftovers from before Easter, which they had continued to use into the next week, which was a little unfortunate.
But apart from that, the venue was great. The noise, the
company,
the bad food,
the company
the
was
parking.
Great.
Nice.
Yeah. No good company. But anyway, you know, I think we'll be going back to the Dice and Fork, which is probably a bit of a noisier venue, but we know what we're getting, and it's, yeah, they've supported us and good food.
We've told you before and we'll tell you again, hotel bar is where it's at. It's quiet. It's a little bit more expensive, but it's a really nice, chilled out venue to sit and drink and talk without, being drowned by noise.
Yeah, but most of the hotels are right in the CBD where parking is difficult, and
you'll have to find one slightly further out and go there. There must be some.
Anyway, when you come up to Auckland next, you can do a reconnaissance mission and find a...
Hang on. Are you talking to me or talking to Bronwyn here? Which one of us is going to do this reconnaissance?
Either of you.
All right. Whoever's up there next can do your work for you.
We need to find one that has a confusing name so that we have to remind everybody every single time to not go to the wrong place.
It's not that the name is confusing. It's just the address is a pain in the arse.
Well, don't give the address.
And we've had people literally, you know, we say go to 2 Grey Street, but not the restaurant, and they still go to the restaurant. So
don't say 2 Grey Street. Just say go to the Intercontinental Hotel Lobby Bar, and that's it. Don't mention the address.
Right. You have been listening to the Fractious Year and a Half podcast.
We love each other really, right? We just want to let our listeners know that we all get on very well, despite what it may sound like.
Yes. Anyway, if you'd like to give us some feedback and some awesome relationship advice, you can send us an email to podcast@skeptics.nz. And we will see you all next time. Bye.
See ya.
Cookie day.